Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross. Tiffany Cross. Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Joe McCormick, and it's Saturday, time for a Vault episode. This episode originally published on October 31st, Halloween Day, 2019, and it's our Anthology of Horror, Volume 3.
That's right. Horror-themed TV anthology episodes that are used as a springboard to discuss science and historical, you know, stuff to blow your mind topics. This one is fun in that one of the anthology episodes that we discuss is a Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode. So if you enjoy the moments where we frequently reference Simpsons episodes, well, then this is the main event because we're going to spend a lot of time talking about the Simpsons here.
Let us be your Kang and Kodos.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind, a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works.
Hello and welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Gooley Lamb.
I forgot we were doing the voices. Let's see. What's my name also? I'm Corrosive Joseph McCormick.
Exactly.
And we're here with our excellent audio producer, Death Nicholas Johnson.
It is Halloween. It is Halloween itself, I believe.
Yeah.
And so we are presenting Anthology of Horror, Volume 3.
So this will be a sequel to our two previous Anthology of Horror episodes where we look at old episodes of horror anthology TV shows and figure out how they might often be deeper than they seem.
Yeah, I mean, and also sometimes they're not very deep, but we have a knack for finding some hidden depth in horror and science fiction.
Now, in the last episode, which should have been just a couple days ago, we talked about an episode of The Twilight Zone concerning mm-hmm. how you can know whether or not you are in a dream or whether you are someone else's dream. And we talked about an episode of the old horror anthology Monsters that featured a story about ghouls called Down Below and related that to cities dealing with rat problems. So today I think we were going to start by looking at an episode of The Outer Limits, right?
Yes, The Sixth Finger. This is the fifth episode of the first season of ABC's sci-fi anthology series, legendary sci-fi anthology series, The Outer Limits, which originally ran from 1963 through 1965. It was created by Leslie Stevens, and unlike a lot of these shows, it didn't have a true horror or sci-fi host. It didn't have like a puppet or an actor that spoke to you and introduced everything, but it did have the control voice, which in and of itself is pretty classic.
Explain the control voice.
Oh, we will control the vertical, we will control the horizontal. You know, it's like this disembodied voice that is taking over your television set and presenting you with some sort of cosmic transmission from the outer limits.
I see. Is this the one that's there's no need to adjust your television
exactly
set? Oh
yes.
Okay, I think I for some reason confused that. I thought that was like an alternate opening to the Twilight Zone. No, that Twilight Zone's always like Rod Serling being like, you are entering another dimension.
So the Outer Limits was definitely more in the science fiction domain. It was in many ways kind of like the sci-fi side of the coin to the Twilight Zone's horror. But it also got a little spooky, a little scary at times, and certainly falls under the domain of our mission statement here.
Now, wait a second. Sorry, I just realized that the Outer Limits introduction you're doing here, this might be the first sort of hint or attempt at doing a kind of found footage thing, right? It's saying like you are receiving a transmission. It's like implying that you're part of the narrative because your TV set is something's being beamed from another place to it.
Yeah, to a limited extent. I mean, once the episode starts, it's pretty clear you're still safely in television land. But you're also in a place that still feels a little less safe.
But this ain't I Love Lucy.
Exactly. So the Outer Limits went two seasons and produced 49 episodes. Again, it's just always amazing just how robust some of these older seasons on television were. Not all of the episodes are classics, but some stand out amid the all-time greatest achievements in science fiction television, even today in this sort of golden age of television and television options. Some of the most famous episodes include, for instance, Demon with a Glass Hand, which was scripted by Harlan Ellison.
Mm-hmm.
But The Sixth Finger is also rather iconic. Like a lot of the episodes, it features some alien makeup effects that are pretty astounding. A lot of the alien designs on the Outer Limits kind of, you know, leaned into old school ideas of what an extraterrestrial might look like. You know, there are a lot of oversized heads and long ears and whatnot.
Like the brain mutant from This Island Earth.
Yeah. So some of them are a little bit dated, but they were still pulled off exceptionally well. Shot in black and white and sometimes with an almost avant-garde kind of style. That being said, there are some effects that they pulled off on that show that stand up, I think, really well today. The Galaxy Being, I think, is an exception, where you had like this kind of sharp contrast of black and white, where it seems to be just radiating on the screen. But The Sixth Finger was directed by James Goldstone, who also directed the pilot for a little show called Star Trek.
Okay, so that's before Kirk is the captain, right?
Right, yeah. And it was written by Ellis St. Joseph, who did a lot of TV work in his career. And it also starred British-American actor David McCallum, who starred opposite Robert Vaughn in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. So McCallum stars in this episode as the character Griffiths, a Welsh miner who agrees to let a rogue scientist named Professor Mathers experiment on him, which is, of course, always a solid life choice.
Right.
Mathers played a role, we're told, in the development of atomic weaponry, and he wants to aid humanity instead. And so he has invented a means of speeding up evolutionary development, and he wants to try it out on a human being.
Now, I can say in the early 1960s, this would actually be not that far-fetched of a scenario. I mean, I think there were a number of scientists who were known at the time to have worked on the creation of atomic weaponry who were deeply publicly regretful of their work even.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Typified for the most part by the heavily quoted bit from Oppenheimer, Now I Am Become Death, where he himself is, of course, quoting Vedic scriptures.
Yeah.
Because certainly the atomic bomb is this, continues to loom over us as this this symbol of great human achievements that are put to work in the name of like our worst impulses as a species, as a civilization.
Totally.
And yeah, so the idea of someone involved with that wanting to do something that saves us, that changes us, that puts us in a different direction, I think that makes perfect sense. And I think a lot of people would agree that, you know, this period of nuclear power, you know, is something we hope – it's kind of a bottleneck, right? It's like it's a period of extreme danger to the species that we hope to move past. We hope to evolve through. And certainly, you know, we tend to think of that evolution as more – less biological and more cultural, more political. But in a science fiction story, you know, it makes sense to go with the more literal interpretation of that. Like human beings need to evolve beyond this point of extreme danger. So I'm going to put a human being inside of a crazy sci-fi contraption and see what kind of, peaceful being comes out the other side.
Right. As you increase our ability to destroy ourselves and one another, it seems like every year that goes by, we're just sort of like barely eking, you know, we're mm-hmm. just making it. If we don't use that power, unless you change us somehow, that it would be inconceivable to us to use it.
Right. Now, to be clear, evolution, as we've discussed plenty of times on the show, is a process of mutation and natural selection that takes place across vast periods of time due to various environmental stressors. Mm-hmm. Would you agree with that? You're more Darwin's bulldog on the show than I am.
I mean, our modern picture of evolution, I think, has become a little bit more nuanced in that we learn more and more things that that affect it, like epigenetic factors, mm-hmm. possibly, and things like that. But basically, I mean, the standard model is that there is variation and then there is selection by the environment. And yeah, the big thing, of course, the way this happens in nature is it happens over many generations. The way evolution is often conceived of in stories like this is it basically just means like changing somebody, like changing an individual's body in their lifetime, which would be different from biological evolution. That would be more like, I don't know, bioengineering of the
right.
body.
Yeah. And also, I mean, the other thing too is this model in this science fiction story, it kind of implies that there's an exact map of our evolution inside of our bodies, inside of our genes, mm-hmm. you know, as if like we're a Pokemon and you can look at a chart saying like how it advances to its final form. If I have my Pokemon references correct, I don't right. know my Pokemon all that well.
Yeah.
But still, yeah, it implies that there's like a certain path that an organism should take and it's all written in the genes as opposed to being this process, driven by this process of natural selection that depends so heavily upon environment.
Yeah.
So on one hand, it's a tad silly to think that some manner of mad science process could simply speed up human evolution. But again, they're trying to make a statement here, so we'll roll with it.
Okay.
So as Griffith evolves, and this is a real talkie, by the way, as far as anthology shows go. And Outer Limits tended to be, I think, a little more cerebral than many of the other anthology and shows that would come in its wake. There's a lot of discussing what this means and discussing how we might apply it to our understanding of the world. And so Griffith, he goes through these a treatment of evolution. Then he comes back out and he's changed and he talks about it. And he goes back in, he gets another treatment, he comes back, he's even different. But basically, these are the changes, biological and mental, that take place. Okay, first of all, he gets an extremely overdeveloped cortex, like a giant alien melon head, which, again, is very impressive makeup effects. But at the same time, it's kind of a dated look for our idea of like a far future being.
Okay, so just to clarify, basically, is the idea that this is naturally how humans would evolve if we were allowed to just, keep living for thousands of years. But the scientist has figured out a way to get us there down the already mapped path ahead of time.
Right. I think that's what the model is here. We just have to sort of, take their word for it on the sci-fi process that's
okay.
getting it to us.
Sure. So huge head. Great.
Right. Now, as the title implies, one of the other major changes is that there is a sixth finger on each hand.
Hmm.
So a total of 12 digits on the hands now.
Better to press nuclear launch buttons with.
Yeah. In addition, long elf ears, which, I don't really have a good discussion lined up for that, but there are elf ears.
Uh-huh.
Mental powers such as telekinesis.
Hmm.
Vastly enhanced intelligence and ultimately enhanced empathy and understanding. And in the original script, he also eventually develops a means of photosynthesis and lives on pure light and kind of transcends into a being of light.
Hmm.
In the show, however, he attempts to push himself even further in evolution, but his wife betrays him out of love and turns him back into his original self, you know, turns back the dial on the evolution machine to try and get the man that she loves back in the room. But the process ends up killing him. It's just too much for him.
Oh, no.
So it all makes for a great mad science tale and one that I think works well thematically. Plus, McCallum has that kind of like old school Leslie Howard delivery, you know, which I really love, because if you're watching a show like The Outer Limits or The Twilight Zone, you do have to find a reason to love some of the more, you know, by today's standards, antiquated aspects of, say, acting or pacing or even the effects. And Joe, I have a picture of the being here for you. And certainly anybody who wants to see this, just look up The Outer Limits, The Sixth Finger. Mm-hmm. You can also find it on like Hulu or Netflix, streaming pretty much everywhere. But you can also find lots of images of this. It's a very iconic costume.
Okay, so first of all, I see the giant melon head. And that looks great because you can fit so much brain in there. I'm immediately imagining some problems having to do with birth. Like the size of the human birth canal, which you would have to assume it would also evolve to be much bigger to allow a birth of that kind of creature. Though I believe it's widely thought that we're already pretty much at sort of the limits of what our bodies will allow in terms of cranial size.
Right. I mean, then the other thing that comes to mind is our discussions in our episode on brain soup and liquefied brains. The actual size of the brain would not be as important as the number of neurons within it.
Right.
So I think by our modern understanding, it was very much in vogue at the time to see like, you know, outsized craniums as being a sign of super intelligence in your fictional creatures. But I think nowadays we realize that that would not be necessary.
Yeah. But I mean, like I already mentioned, this island Earth, it shows up in a lot of sci-fi from the mid-century that you've got aliens with huge old heads, I guess because they're very smart. But also I like how he's got extremely defined facial bone structure. Like this guy has cheekbones to die for.
He does, yes. And then, of course, there are the elf ears, which, again, we don't really have anything to say about them. I'm not sure what pointy ears would really accomplish evolutionarily.
Oh, man, this seems like something that has to have been explored in a kind of speculative paper. Like somebody who's an expert on the morphology of the ears and how they help you hear. How would you hear differently if you had elf ears?
I don't know. I bet we should come back to that, because if there is a good answer for it, there's a whole world of elven ear structure that we could discuss in the future. But what I want to talk about is that extra finger.
Okay.
So we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we will get into the five-digit rule in vertebrate evolution, and we'll discuss the possibility of a sixth finger coming into play.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. So we've been talking about the classic Outer Limits episode, The Sixth Finger, about a man who speeds up his own evolution within his own lifetime, and he gets a gigantic melon head. He gets really defined facial bones, beautiful cheekbones. He gets elf ears, but he also grows a sixth finger. And so, Robert, you looked into what it would mean to grow a sixth finger. Is that kind of thing possible? Why or why would not we? Why wouldn't we see that in human evolution or primate evolution?
Yeah, it's really fascinating because, first of all, the five-digit rule does run pretty deep in vertebrate evolution. According to Michael Coates, associate professor in the Department of Organismal Biology and Anatomy at the University of Chicago and co-editor of Evolution and Development, writing for Scientific American, the condition of having no more than five fingers and toes probably goes back before the evolutionary divergence of amphibians and amniotes, birds, mammals, reptiles. Mm-hmm. We're talking 340 million years ago. Go back 360 million years ago, and there's evidence of tetrapods with six, seven, eight digits. The decrease to five or fewer came about alongside the development of sophisticated wrist and ankle joints.
Hmm.
So basically, the creatures with more digits had simpler skeletons and simpler limb mobility. And they were generally, you know, something along the line of flippers, because we're talking about creatures of the water here. But as these limbs evolved to allow certain organisms to stand or to push off with those limbs, essentially, you know, as they move towards being land creatures, we see the reduction of digits. And indeed, we tend to see, you know, the further reduction of digits, because the rule of evolutionary thumb here is that it's easier to lose something than it is to gain something.
Absolutely. I mean, you can see that with many tetrapod mammals today, for example. Look at a dog's paw. I mean, they have a sort of vestigial other thumb type thing up there on the leg, but basically they got four toes that go go down on the ground.
It's the, what, the dew claw?
Yeah. 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 Up there. Or, I mean, even look at the feet of ungulates.
Yeah. I mean, horses are a great place to look because we see how far it's reduced now. But, you know, various prehistoric horses had 3 or 4 toes. And when animals actually do gain digits, well, Coates points out that the lack of true six-toed or six-fingered creatures in today's fauna, quote, highlights some sort of constraint. For instance, one of the rare cases we see of, you know, of a creature gaining digits is the marine reptile Ichthyosaurus. This is the these lived 65 million years ago. We've talked about them on the show before. They essentially are dolphin-like creatures. They have that same sort of shape, but they are reptiles. And as a result of returning to the sea, they eventually developed paddles that sometimes had, you know, quite a number of digits in there.
Okay, so the Ichthyosaurus, like the marine mammals of today, in their evolutionary history, went to land and then went back to water.
Right, yeah. So, which again lines up nicely with this idea of yeah, as long as you're a sea creature, you can have multiple digits within that paddle. Mm-hmm. But if, when you start using that paddle increasingly, again, over, you know, generation after generation after generation, if it's used to push off, if it's used even to hold up your weight, it becomes increasingly more beneficial to have fewer digits in that at the end of that limb. However, we do see creatures like the mole and the panda, both of which benefit from remodeled wrist bones that essentially serve as a sixth finger, but which are not true fingers. And if you haven't seen a picture of this, I encourage everyone to look up pictures of a panda's paw or the claws of a mole. And you will, you know, if you start doing some counting, you'll be like, okay, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and oh, kind of 6. Again, not a true thumb, but for the panda, for instance, it serves as a thumb. It has the, like the role of a thumb in helping them handle food. The panda, of course, is the herbivore of the bear world, and it has to eat constantly, and therefore it has eventually reached the point where it needs a little extra thumb-like appendage to get the job done. Meanwhile, for moles, this extra little thumb-like appendage, it helps them tunnel through the earth.
Oh, so being almost more like a flipper.
Yeah. Yeah, help it swim through the earth. Yeah. These are, in Coates' words, quote, rather baroque solutions to the apparently straightforward task of growing an extra finger. So, you know, if we're to think back to our Outer Limits example here, it would be far more likely that one would grow some sort of a a paddle of a pseudo finger as opposed to growing a full finger. No matter how many keyboards you're having to use, no matter, you know, how many, mad science gadgets you're having to manipulate with your far future digits. But I want to talk about another even more amazing example from real-world biology.
Okay.
And for this, we have to turn to the world of the lemur. As recently reported in Smithsonian, the eye-eye lemur, known for its weird looks and its elongated middle finger, which it uses to fish grubs out of trees. You may have seen this in various documentaries before. It looks like a tree goblin.
Right.
And it's, I think it has unfortunately suffered from like superstitious killings in the past. But it has this, it's nocturnal, and it has this fabulous, super elongated, in some people's eyes, they might think it's creepy, middle finger, which it uses to fish out a grub, and then it's you know, it's this highly specialized digit, and once it gets the grub out, I was reading that it'll also like pluck the top of the grub off and like suck the inside of the grub out, like it is just a highly evolved grub eater.
Wow!
But in addition to this, it also boasts an extra tiny thumb or pseudo thumb, complete with a fingerprint. This, according to Adam Harstone Rose, associate professor of biological sciences at North Carolina State University. It's a pseudo thumb made of bone and cartilage, but it can be moved in 3 directions, much like a human thumb. Now, you might wonder why. Why is this creature so greedy for crazy digits?
Yeah.
It already has this super elongated, specialized digit. What does it need an extra digit for?
You know what I realize the eye-eye hand reminds me of? I just looked it up to see it again. It reminds me of the of Klaus Kinski's hands in Werner Herzog's Nosferatu.
Oh, yeah.
He's got the long nails and the creepy fingers.
Yeah, it does seem like a true creature of the night, doesn't it? But basically, it seems to have developed this additional pseudo-thumb because the other fingers are elongated and specialized. Like, essentially, it's lost that middle finger, the specialized usage. Mm. And so it has had to develop a pseudo-thumb to make up for that specialization. And to be clear, you'll sometimes find a sixth finger occurring on a human as a birth defect. And in fact, since we're celebrating Halloween, it's worth noting that Hannibal Lecter in the books has an extra digit on his left hand. Mm-hmm. That occurs, but it is not, you know, it's not a naturally evolved feature. Mm-hmm. So you're probably wondering, where does this leave our six-fingered man in the Outer Limits? So Griffith kind of essentially dodges the question when at one point a scientist actually asks him about the sixth finger, like, what's up with that extra finger? And he just kind of starts talking about something else. But it's implied, especially given the prior scene in which he plays a piano, that it enables the better manipulation of interface tools, like the keys of a piano or the keys of a computer, etc.
Now, this is suggesting this would be selected for in evolution, that would imply that at some point people are like dying or not reproducing as much because they can't type as fast.
Yeah. Yeah, that's where we get into some problems with this model if you look at it too closely. I also had to realize, as I was typing up notes for this, I was hyper-conscious of how little I actually use my pinky fingers while typing. Mm-hmm. Now, ultimately, I'm probably using some sort of weird hybrid of actual typing with a little hunt and peck thrown in there. Mm-hmm. But I don't know that I use my pinkies all that much, if at all, unless I'm doing some sort of weird hotkey.
I definitely use mine.
Yeah.
Yeah. Huh. Yeah. Yeah. It's that semicolon, you know, for all the semicolon sentences. No, I've got to think about it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I do it.
Okay. All right. Yeah, to each his own.
Sorry, I'm not bragging. I mean,
no. I mean,
just because my pinky fingers are way better than yours.
Well, you know, they're not holding me back. I'm just saying that, like, you know, when I catch myself typing, I'm like, oh, I don't think the pinkies are really carrying their weight here. Hmm. So, it's kind of silly to imagine a scenario in which being able to type extra hard and be able to hit like crazier hotkeys on a keyboard mm-hmm. would have this kind of impact on human evolution. At the same time,
maybe it's for the next level of PC gaming.
Yeah, that's right. But on the other hand, it is true that habitual tool use has led to the evolved state of the modern human hand, including thumb length. So tool use has shaped our bodies. It has shaped our hand in the past. So it's not ridiculous to say that the future human evolution would continue to reshape the human hand.
Sure. But there you would be contending with the fact that I think there's, you know, in the environments that we mostly live in today, not being able to use a tool as well doesn't usually mean that you're going to, you know, on average have fewer children than the people right next door. That seems like a thing that would be more the case in like a hunter-gatherer survival scenario.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, ultimately, we have to remember that we're no longer subject to purely natural selection at this stage of the human experience. You know, it's more of an unnatural selection. We also have to consider the potential of directed evolution, that we will in the future continue to figure out ways to manipulate our own genes.
Yeah.
Which brings up the possibility that perhaps our far future selves have simply added on an extra finger. Mm-hmm. Like, it's not a situation where we evolved one, but we realized, hey, having two pinkies on each hand would be nice. Let's do it. And then we just do it. We just check it off on the menu of gene manipulation, which reminds me of Les Grossman's The Magicians and the sci-fi TV series that's based on it. There's a dark wizard in the show called the Beast, mm-hmm. and he has an extra finger on each hand because in The Magicians, casting spells involves a lot of like fine manipulation of your digits, like sort of like the use of mudras and whatnot. So if you had an extra digit on each hand, you'd be able to cast improved variations of spells. You'd be able to cast spells that a normal individual with five digits would be incapable of.
Well, that makes me wonder who invented those spells then. I mean, I guess they're of his own creation.
Well, yes. And of course, there are a lot of inhuman entities in this world as well.
Oh, so okay.
He could be going to them for such spells. However, you know, in discussing this idea of, like, you know, growing extra fingers to manipulate technology, et cetera, as Peter Ward pointed out in his Scientific American article, The Future of Man, How Will Evolution Change Humans? We also have to consider, not only like computer interfaces like keyboards, but more drastic interfaces, some of the sort of futuristic mind-computer interfaces that we've discussed in the show before.
Mm-hmm.
He points to a quote from George Dyson in his 1998 book, Darwin Among the Machines. Quote, "Everything that human beings are doing to make it easier to operate computer networks is at the same time, but for different reasons, making it easier for computer networks to operate human beings. Darwinian evolution, in one of those paradoxes with which life abounds, may be a victim of its own success, unable to keep up with non-Darwinian processes that it has spawned."
I think there's a lot to that. I mean, I would say, this is in the 1990s before you could anticipate a lot of the stuff that's going on now with, say, social media and the many ways that our technology is influencing us. But yeah, just one thing I would say here is that this person probably lived through the transition from command line computers to graphical user interfaces.
Yeah.
And so obviously having a graphical user interface makes it way easier for people who don't know much about how the computer works or understanding directories and commands and all that stuff to use it, because it's intuitive. It's easy. You just look at the thing, you recognize it, you click on it, all that. But also those graphical user interfaces, I think, led to all of the ways that computers are now just completely attention monopolizing devices.
Absolutely. So Ward basically concludes that we'll have to go one of three different ways as humans continue to evolve. There's the stasis direction, where we mainly just stay the same, but with minor tweaks, and also a kind of merging of races.
Mm-hmm.
There's also speciation, in which we break off into different species, and hopefully none of them are Morlocks, because ultimately speciation is the model that H.G. Wells explores in The Time Machine. And then he also talks about the Borg route, which is symbiosis with machines.
I find it kind of hard to believe that there could be human speciation unless you're talking about space colonization, like fully separating human populations from one another so that they cannot physically come together at all for, you know, hundreds of years.
Even if you sent some of them below ground to man all the machines and keep the surface world running?
Well, I guess it would depend on whether you could go back and forth between. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think as long as humans stay in physical contact with each other, I find it hard to believe that there will be actual human speciation. But then, yeah, space colonization does seem like that's a possibility.
That creates a kind of like a certain hard divide. It is the equivalent of having a species wind up on an island,
right,
and co-evolve. So Ward doesn't specifically chime in on the six-finger thing. He doesn't reference that. But he does dismiss the idea of giant-brained, futurized humans like we see in the sixth finger.
Uh-huh.
He says, quote, "The big brain vision has no real scientific basis. The fossil record of skull sizes over the past several thousand generations shows that our days of rapid increase in brain size are long over."
Yeah. In fact, we already peaked, right? Our average brain sizes in the modern world are smaller than they used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. But ultimately, this episode of Outer Limits is not just about biological evolution. It's about the evolution of what it means to be human. Is there a potential for us to change in a more meaningful way? Can we become, for instance, more empathetic? Can we become more present as a species, kinder? This is the idea that the episode is playing with and hoping for. And ultimately, like, that's where it gets to at the end. With this, the character, while he's still more human, is, possessed by this quest for vengeance against the people who operate the mine in which he works.
Mm.
And by the end of it, he has evolved beyond these feelings of vengeance. Like, there's a period in the episode where he wants to use his crazy, future brain powers to go, wreak havoc on them. But by the end of it, he realizes, no, that is not the way.
Well, I would say I think it certainly is possible for us to become more empathetic, less vengeful and violent and all that kind of stuff. But I don't think you necessarily need biological changes for that to happen. I mean, I think we've seen massive changes in the levels of like violence and vengefulness you see in the average person across different societies through time. And the main changes are through like culture, like social norms, how children are educated, what's acceptable socially within your friend groups and the culture.
Right. So changes in the software as opposed to the hardware.
Yeah.
But then, of course, we have to consider like the rate at which software can change and the rate at which it may evolve. No matter how pleasant a human civilization's current software may be, how much has to happen to it to make it, well, to use a naughty word on this show, devolve into some lesser state?
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess that's the danger. I mean, yeah, cultural changes can be undone maybe as quickly as they can be done or even quicker.
By the way, I was reading about the original script and the production of this episode of The Outer Limits. And according to The Outer Limits Companion by David J. Sko, Dorothy Brown, the ABC censor at the time, had objected to the Darwinism and promotion of evolution inherent in the sixth finger.
Whoa.
So, one of the early deletions from the script was a speech on the topic of evolution.
Well, that's funny. I mean, again, like to really explore the what's happening to the character in the episode is not actually Darwinian right. evolution, but that's funny. Yeah, I mean, I guess it does rely on the idea that there's like a roadmap for our species generally, which also is not part of Darwinian evolution.
Right. Yeah. So it's not really hitting the viewer over the head with a hardcore speech on evolution, but I think just the mere fact that they were citing evolution and speaking of evolution and the works of Darwin as being something that we can actually, hang our scientific hat on, they were afraid it was going to offend people.
Well, yeah, I mean, I grew up surrounded by that kind of opposition and sensitivity to ideas about evolution. But I don't know, despite that, I'm kind of surprised that it made ABC censorship priorities.
Yeah, especially in a show like this, which, ultimately is, kind of high-minded and stuffy. Well, I guess also trading in science fiction, which would have had a certain amount of appeal to younger audiences as well.
Yeah.
But still, I have to say this is a pretty solid episode of The Outer Limits. I think it stands up really well today. You have to go into it knowing you're not going to get an action-packed episode here. This is a very talky episode. Uh-huh. But it's really solid. Well shot, well acted. Worth checking out.
I think a lot of the best anthology sci-fi and horror episodes are not actually action-packed. Mm-hmm. They often tend to be rather subdued, just dealing with a strange idea as discussed by a handful of characters.
Yeah, and sometimes you do see this kind of unevenness to the perceived budget of a show. Like, that some of those anthology episodes, maybe they had a few more bucks to spend on the cast, on the locations, and some are essentially kind of bottle episodes where there's just like one set or it's almost kind of a stage piece. Mm-hmm. But there is, when it's really well done, that'll certainly get you there.
To Serve Man isn't action-packed either, is it?
Yeah. No, it's just, and that's one that we talked about last year.
Right.
Speaking of, Joe, what is your selection, your final selection for this year's anthology of horror episodes?
Well, I wanted to talk about my favorite all-time Simpsons Treehouse of Horror episode, Citizen Kang. This is from Simpsons Treehouse of Horror 7. It originally aired October 27th, 1996. And I think this is not only one of my favorite Simpsons bits ever. I think it is some of the best political satire in American media history.
Yeah, this is just a great Treehouse episode, period. I rewatched it the other night with the family, and I must have seen it a dozen times in the past, because in addition to Citizen Kang, it also contains the Genesis Tub. This is where Lisa's tooth grows of civilization it gets a little static shock from Bart, which is very similar to a tale by George R. R. Martin that was adapted by the 1990s revival of The Outer Limits, more or less along the same time. And then this this episode also has The Thing and I, which is a great, more of sort of a straight up horror piece, which contains a twist ending that I have to say is nearly identical to the twist ending of a certain top 2019 horror film.
Oh, okay. Well, let's not say any more than that.
But I think you know the one, right?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about, but I don't want to spoil it for anybody else. All right, we need to take a quick commercial break, but we will be right back.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road, the steeper the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is an NAACP and Webby Award-winning podcast dedicated to all things mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. Here, we have the conversations that help Black women decipher how their past inform who they are today and use that information to decide who they want to be moving forward. We chat about things like how to establish routines that center self-care, what burnout looks and feels like, and defining what aspects of our lives are making us happy and what parts are holding us back. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia. And I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Thank you.
Okay, so this Simpsons Treehouse of Horror, again, it aired at the end of October 1996. And at the time it actually aired, the United States was right in the final days of a presidential election that was pitting incumbent Democratic President Bill Clinton against Republican Senator Bob Dole from Kansas. And in this Treehouse of Horror segment, alien invaders Kang and Kodos, who are from a certain ringed planet who they prefer not to mention, they plot to take over the world by body snatching both Clinton and Dole and taking their places in the election as lookalikes. And the idea is stated pretty directly by Kang in the guise of Bob Dole. A reporter asks the Kang Dole, Senator Dole, why should people vote for you instead of President Clinton? And Kang Dole responds, it makes no difference which one of us you vote for. Either way, your planet is doomed. Doomed. Replacing both. That's a good idea, right?
Yeah, then there's no risk, right? Either right. way, they're going to win.
Yeah. So in this little plot, Homer becomes aware of the alien takeover plot because he happened to be on the alien ship when Clinton and Dole were replicated. So he decides he's got to reveal Kang and Kodos for what they are. So he runs on stage at an event, I think at the Capitol building, where both candidates are speaking, and he rips off their disguises, revealing them both as hideous space reptiles. But Kang and Kodos seem unfazed, declaring, it's true, we are aliens, but what are you going to do about it? It's a two-party system. You have to vote for one of us. And then somebody in the crowd suggests voting for a third-party candidate. And Kodo says, go ahead, throw your vote away. So the Americans, of course, end up electing Kang, who immediately enslaves all humans, and he puts them to work constructing a giant laser to aim at some third unspecified planet. And then Marge laments the state of affairs that they're suffering under right now, and Homer smugly declares, don't blame me. I voted for Kodo. I think this might be the best 9 minutes of political satire in American pop culture history. And I don't want to be misunderstood there based on some of the themes in the episode, because, of course, a major theme here is the pointlessness and futility of some parts of the democratic process. I don't want to be mistaken for saying I think it makes no difference who you vote for president, or that all politicians are the same. You know, I think that's the kind of thing that it's like easy to say and feel superior about saying when you don't want to put in the work to learn what's going on and what's at stake.
Right.
It was the kind of statement I would have found very attractive when I was like a first-year college student, kind of intellectually lazy but wanting to stake a moral claim.
Yeah, or wanting to differentiate yourself from the politics that you might have been born into.
Yeah.
It's easier to, instead of saying, actually, I disagree with you completely and I go to this side, you can just say, oh, I don't go for any of it.
Right. I can remember being like that. I wanted to have a strong opinion without having to do the work to earn an opinion.
Right.
So I don't think that way anymore. But at the same time, while I don't generally feel that's always true about elections, I think there is some real cutting wisdom in that satire, because even though it's not the case that all politicians are the same and elections don't matter, people often overestimate how much their democratic choice will make a difference to particular issues they really care about. There are so many big problems that you thought electing the right person might solve, and then that person was elected and the problem stayed the same or got worse. But even more than that, I think this episode is brilliant at highlighting the absurd and nonsensical conclusions often reached by group choice algorithms that we follow in our politics. And that's sort of what I wanted to look at here in relation to this episode. In that vein, I want to explore the question of whether or not the election of Kang is an example of the Abilene paradox.
Hmm.
Now, Robert, had you ever come across this concept before?
I don't believe I had, no.
Yeah, I think this is very useful to have in your toolkit of concepts to apply to the world, because it's absolutely something that explains many unfortunate group behaviors in politics, in business, even in like family vacations and hangouts with your friends. So this paradox was explained in a 1974 paper by the George Washington University scholar Jerry B. Harvey, which was published in the journal Organizational Dynamics. And I'm going to give a kind of updated scenario here for you to consider. So imagine the following scenario. You are hanging out with your friends PJ, Nancy, and Jamie Lee. It's October. You're all just finished babysitting. You're at Nancy's house carving a pumpkin, and you're watching an old Howard Hawks movie on TV, The Thing from Another World. You're hanging out. You're having an okay time. But then suddenly Nancy says, "Hey, does anybody want to go out and see a movie?" And PJ says, "Yeah, that could be cool. Let's see what's playing." So you look up showtimes at the local theater, and the only show left tonight is a midnight showing of The Purge 17 as the world purges. So PJ says, "Yeah, we could see that if you guys want." And Nancy says, "Yeah, okay, I could be down to go to The Purge." And Jamie Lee says, "Sure, if you two want to see it, I'm in." So since all of your friends agreed, you resign yourself. You say, "Okay, let's see it." Tickets are $14 a piece. The movie stars Fred Durst and Tim Allen. It's 3.5 hours long. At multiple moments, you consider leaving the theater, but you don't want to go out alone and leave your friends behind. So you sit through this whole terrible movie, and when the credits finally roll, you leave the theater with a throbbing headache, and you immediately ask, "Why did we do that to ourselves?" And Jamie Lee says, "I don't know. It sounded pretty bad to me, but I thought the rest of you wanted to see it." And Nancy says, "Well, I didn't want to see it. I just thought the rest of you did." And PJ says, "Well, don't look at me. I just said I was okay with it if you guys wanted to go. Weren't you the one who suggested it?" And Nancy, the one who did suggest going to a movie, finally says, "Well, I just thought you guys might be bored hanging out at the house." So it turns out that none of the four of you actually wanted to see this movie, and yet somehow you collectively decided it would be the best thing to do with your time together. Everybody agreed on a course of action that nobody individually wanted. Robert, can I assume this experience is somewhat familiar to you?
Yeah, maybe from I think probably the best example I can think of is like when, as a family, when I was a kid, sometimes we would agree on what to watch. Mm-hmm. And, you know, sometimes it's something that one of us had a definite stake in. But other times it kind of felt like this, where we ended up agreeing to watch a movie just because it was a major film that came out. And we're like, okay, I guess we're watching, I can't even think of a good example. But just some, you know, whatever the big mainstream family film was that had hit theaters and was now on VHS.
Christmas with the Cranks.
Well, maybe not that bad, but stuff like that, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah, so this would be a prime example of what Harvey calls the Abilene Paradox. And the name Abilene Paradox comes from the story Jerry Harvey tells to open his paper. It's similar to the story I told, but it's about a family in Texas making a long drive to Abilene in a non-air-conditioned car in hot weather. It's a completely miserable experience, as you would expect. And it turns out nobody actually wanted to go to Abilene in the first place. Every member of the family just thought the other family members wanted to go and then failed to communicate their actual preferences. And as Harvey puts it in his article, the Abilene Paradox is the fact that, quote, "organizations frequently take actions in contradiction to what they really want to do and therefore defeat the very purposes they're trying to achieve." And he characterizes the Abilene Paradox as not a failure to manage disagreement, but a failure to manage agreement. So when I first read about this at some point in the past couple of years, I was like, oh, my God, this kind of thing. I recognize so much of this in the world. How have I gone this long without a name for it? It seems to me to be a problem for group choice at all kinds of levels. Again, you mentioned, a family trying to decide what movie to see, a group of friends trying to decide what to do, how to spend their Sunday, or a democratic society trying to elect their leaders. Many kinds of group choice problems, I think, arise, of course, from the inability to manage conflict. But this is the opposite. Harvey argues that even more group choice problems arise from the inability to manage agreement. And another real-world example that Harvey gives in his paper is the Watergate scandal. He quotes a number of people involved in the Nixon campaign's Dirty Tricks team, who all claimed privately that they had doubts not only about the morality but about the practical wisdom of their scheme. That to each of them privately, it seemed like the payoffs were not really worth the risks, but they each assumed they were the only ones with such doubts and thus acted along with the rest to the group in a way that hurt all of them, even though they privately most or all thought it was a bad idea.
So it's like Nixon wants to purge. Lilly wants to purge. So I guess I don't really want to purge, but if everybody's in the mood to purge, I guess I'm in.
Right. And in a lot of his paper, Harvey just analyzes what he sees are like the he thinks the common organizational symptoms of the Abilene paradox. For example, he talks about the idea of action anxiety. He explains this by quoting Shakespeare's Hamlet. He says action anxiety is that which, quote, makes us rather bear those ills we have than fly to others we know not of, which, of course, is what, you know, Hamlet talks about, the idea of going on through pain rather than like ending it and going on to see what undiscovered country lies beyond the grave.
Yeah.
But it's a fear of acting on your actual preferences, an environment that makes pursuing the path that you don't want seem like the less scary option than asking for the path that you do want.
Well, that's also touched on a little bit in Macbeth, right? The idea about having waded so far through the blood that it's better to just go on through to the other side of this blood lake than to turn back around, even if turning back around is what you really want to do.
Yeah. And Harvey roots a lot of this actually in appeals to human psychology. He says, you know, some of our greatest fears are expressed as negative fantasies about fears of separation and ostracization. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, it's like terrifying to be the one to step out and say, I'm going to challenge the momentum of this group that, you know, that like whether it's even in simple things like going out to a movie, like you're going out to a movie with friends. I mean, maybe you're comfortable enough with the friends to say, no, actually, I don't want to do this. But like a lot of times, especially if you don't know people as well, you'd rather just not be thought of as the jerk who said, let's not do it.
Yeah, because you're engaging in you're kind of engaging in this groupthink, you know, even if it's something as simple as say like, a group of friends getting together to play Dungeons and Dragons. You know, you're not a dirty tricks council or whatever.
Right.
You know, you're not. You know, all you're doing is just trying to hang out and play a game. But you know, still don't want to shake the boat if somebody wants to get fried pickles. You know.
Right.
Even if you really don't care for fried pickles all that much.
Right. But maybe the person who suggested it doesn't either, and they're just saying it because they thought somebody else did.
Yeah. And so you reach a point where every week you order fried pickles, even though nobody's really crazy about fried pickles, and everybody probably feels a little bad about eating them every week.
Yeah. So in the end, Harvey comes up with a couple of recommendations for diagnosing and dealing with Abilene paradoxes in a business context. Unfortunately, there's no special magic trick. Basically, he says he thinks the best way to deal with it is for an authority figure who detects a situation like this to call a meeting, frankly articulate their doubts in a group setting, and then ask others to share their honest thoughts. If you're an authority figure, you have, you know, it's safer for you to go out on a limb and question the direction that you're going in.
Well, right. I mean, that's why they make the big bucks, right? This is the moment when they can really earn that higher pay grade, right?
Right.
Be the authority figure that comes in and shuts down, you know, things that nobody really wants to do or that there's no real advantage to doing from a business standpoint.
Yeah. Now, in the political context, I think the Kang and Kodo situation kind of highlights a satirical, absurd version of this, with the idea that you know, obviously humans would all recognize like, okay, we are all in agreement. We're in agreement. We don't want either Kang or Kodos. Mm-hmm. That's the position shared by everybody voting at this point. But they're able to cause this action anxiety about organizing any kind of third option. The idea of throwing your vote away on any kind of third party candidate when you've got Kang and Kodos there is going out on a limb. You fear ostracization. You fear being separated. You fear being different. And so eventually they just kind of decide, well, which one will I take, Kang or Kodos? And despite everybody agreeing that neither option is wanted.
But it keeps everybody together. I mean, humanity is united at the end in their enslavement to these terrible alien overlords.
No, they're not. They're still bickering. Don't blame me. Well, I voted for Kodos. I think that's the genius of it.
Essentially unified, but they still have the mindset of division.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And so I think the way around that, of course, would be that it requires some kind of risk of leadership for somebody to say, hey, wait a minute. Can we try to organize some way to get around this the two options we've got here that we all agree we don't want?
That sounds like a really wicked problem to deal with, though.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think the point the writers are making there is that we're just not good at organizing that kind of agreement effectively.
Yeah.
Now, what do we do about the fact that we're often not good at managing agreement, and this leads to repeated absurdities like the Kang and like the election of Kang? Well, he actually Harvey ends his paper with a strangely philosophical note for an organizational dynamics paper. He says that, you know, sometimes these situations simply cannot be resolved. And he calls to mind the myth of Sisyphus, the character from Greek mythology who is condemned to forever repeat the task of pushing a boulder up a hill only for it to fall back down to the bottom again, making a mockery of his efforts as not only painful but pointless. And in Albert Camus' version of the myth, he adds a detail that sometimes in his endless loop of absurd toil, Sisyphus would get near the top of the hill but then release the boulder of his own accord, letting it roll back down to the bottom on purpose. And Harvey says in this act, he could transcend the absurdity of his struggle. And I think this is sort of the bullseye of existential philosophy, right? Life is absurd, and you transcend that absurdity by recognizing your radical freedom and acting authentically, which means basically without lying to yourself about the absurdity of life.
Like this is when you write in a third candidate.
No, I think actually in this case it might be more like voting for Kang or not voting or something while recognizing the absurdity and unwinnableness of the scenario.
Okay.
So I don't know if that's the best thing to do in the alien election. I would say actually try to organize the third party. But I think this whole discussion actually does bring us back to real questions about the field of astropolitics. I mean, this is something I think we could devote whole episodes to in the future. There's actually a field of study, and people have written about, like, what would happen if aliens arrived on Earth? Like, would be the political response to that? How would different world economic and military powers behave? You know, would we all band together? Would we put aside our differences and our self-interest and say we need to organize and act together as Earth, or would aliens be able to exploit our petty grievances and our differences and turn us against one another? And I think, unfortunately, there are some pretty good signs pointing toward the latter.
Yeah, I mean, our only model for intelligent life in the cosmos is our model of intelligent life, of a technologically advanced civilization. And when we look at the way that, civilizations have interacted with each other. Mm-hmm. Certainly look at the way that Western colonization, how that transpired. We see time and time again basically the Kang and Kodos model. Manipulate their leaders and their leadership, corrupt their rule, mm-hmm. work one side against the other, ultimately overpower and bring enslavement and death. I mean, that is the story of human history, sadly. And so when we look to the stars, you know, there are plenty of people who have said, well, that's basically what we can expect based on our models, based on our knowledge of our self-knowledge of how we work. Mm-hmm. That is what we can expect from a superior technological force.
Like, we want to imagine the Independence Day scenario where we all come together and join forces, but I don't know. I don't want to be overly optimistic.
Yeah. I mean, you know, unless we look to our optimism in the sixth finger, and I mm-hmm. think a lot of people have. I mean, a lot of – certainly the various new age religions that have popped up around the idea of aliens. Mm-hmm. You know, they look to aliens as a possibly we're all messed up in this world, and we are, you know, we have just committed crime after crime, and we're shackled to the terror of history. Maybe something will come down from above that has evolved beyond this state and that can guide us, that can help us find this new shape of being. And, you know, maybe that's the case. But again, if we're looking at our own example of intelligent life, I'm not sure that that's going to happen.
I wouldn't put hope in aliens being a good influence on us. I wouldn't put hope in us biologically evolving beyond our petty grievances and all that. I think the hope lies in culture, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And thus it is up to people like writers and political leaders and those kinds of figures to help shape human culture in a way that allows us to act collectively in our own best interest. I know that's not the easiest thing to put hope in, but I think that might be the only hope, personally.
Yeah, I mean, well, that's the hard answer. That's the difficult answer, but it's the one that requires us to work. That's the one that requires us to do the heavy lifting here.
Yeah, we got to fix our own problems mostly using words.
Yeah. All right. I'm sure we'll come back to this topic in the future.
I think we could do some stuff on astropolitics. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. I would be down for that. Absolutely. But there you have it. This is going to be our third installment of the Anthology of Horror. Kang and Kodos willing, we will return next October with at least a volume four, if not a volume four and five. Mm-hmm. And of course, ironically, that'll be pretty much just right before the peak moment of American politics heading into the next presidential election.
Oh, probably won't do politics when then.
Probably not. All right. In the meantime, if you want to check out other episodes of Stuff to Blow Your Mind, head on over to stufftoblowyourmind.com. That's where you'll find them. You can also find the podcast wherever you get your podcasts. But again, this was Anthology of Horror Volume 3. Volume 2 came out Tuesday, and we reran Volume 1 over the weekend. Also, if you want to check out our other show, Invention, you can find that at inventionpod.com, and that's available everywhere you get your podcasts. And also the fiction podcast, The Second Oil Age, launched as well. The first three episodes of that are live wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, congratulations, man.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. All right. So that's it for this episode. Certainly, we have not seen all of the horror anthology episodes out there. We are not familiar with all the shows. So from now until next October, if you have specific episodes of various anthology shows you would like us to consider for next time, let us know. If there are just whole shows, whole buckets of content that we're not aware of, please enlighten us. One of the cool places you can find us for that is our Facebook discussion group. It is the Stuff to Blow Your Mind discussion module. Go check that out.
Huge thanks, as always, to our excellent audio producer, Seth Nicholas Johnson. No, wait, Death Nicholas Johnson.
That's right.
If you would like to get in touch with us directly with feedback on this episode or any other, to suggest a topic for the future, or just to say hello, you can email us at contact@stufftoblowyourmind.com.
Stuff to Blow Your Mind is a production of iHeartRadio's How Stuff Works. For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to Across Generations, where the voices of Black women unite. I'm your host, Tiffany Cross.
Tiffany Cross.
Join me and be a part of sisterhood, friendship, wisdom, and laughter. We gather a seasoned elder, myself as the middle generation, and a vibrant young soul for engaging intergenerational conversations. Prepare to engage or hear perspectives that literally no one else has had. Listen to Across Generations podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Imagine you ask two people the same seven questions. I'm Minnie Driver, and this was the idea I set out to explore in my podcast, Mini Questions. This year, we bring a whole new group of guests to answer the same seven questions, including Courtney Cox, Rob Delaney, Liz Phair, and many, many more. Join me on season three of Mini Questions on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Seven questions, limitless answers.